Hello and welcome to the programme. You can visit our website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Today, Eanna Launa extols the virtues of planting trees during National Tree Week.
We've planted since the National Tree Week began 30 years ago. We've planted something like 250,000 trees for Ireland. The Tree Council has. So it does make a significant difference. And they do survive. Cuntis Mohawk, the most of them do, Derek. They do, really.
Niall Hatch tells us about a close encounter he had with mandarin ducks.
So it's a bird that I've been fortunate enough to see in the wild in the Russian Far East near to Vladivostok and also in Japan. And I had the very unusual experience of actually seeing a whole group of mandarins in the town of Satsuma. So it was a very citrus fruit related day when I saw those.
And the Irish founder of the Kindred Spirit Elephant Sanctuary in North Thailand tells us about elephant foraging and how extreme weather conditions makes it difficult for the elephant to find food.
So right now in northern Thailand, everywhere is basically on fire. All of the forests are on fire. There's many agricultural burning of the fields as well during this time of the year, which unfortunately has resulted in many elephants not being able to forage as naturally as they previously would have been able to. And this happens every year, but especially this year in our area, we have 60 plus elephants that are currently trying to survive this crisis period, survive this pandemic without the tourists, and there is just not enough food to feed all of them. So quite often we need to be making a 3-hour journey to find food for all of these elephants. So it's a very difficult time for all.
And you can hear that very interesting interview Richard did with Kerry McRae a little bit later on in the programme. Now, I want to take you back to last Wednesday when we announced the winner of the inaugural RTE Eye on Nature Wildlife Photography Competition. The winner is Larry Doherty from Thurles in County Tipperary, and his winning photograph is of an orange ladybird taken at the Cabra Wetlands.
Well, I'm a macro photographer anyway. I do a lot of insect macro photography, and I go to the Cabra Wetlands a lot. So it was just a typical day for me. Went to the Cabra Wetlands searching for stuff, and I came upon a small beech tree, and there was a ladybird, an orange ladybird, in between two branches, kind of breaking off. I get the macro camera out and take a picture. It's an orange ladybird. They're about 5 millimetres to 6 millimetres long. They have roughly 16 white spots, and they have translucent edges to their wing cases and the pronotum. If you get close to them, you see the eyes, but just over the eyes, it's like a transparent shield, nearly. They live on trees, mainly sycamore, but I found them on birch. A bit harder to find than the most common seven spot, but still easy enough, but you know where to look.
That was Larry speaking about the moment. He snapped the winning photograph. He picks up a cheque for €1,000. Well done to him when you consider we had in excess of 7,000 entries. It's no mean feat, and I can assure you it is a cracking photograph. If you live within 5 kilometres of the National Botanic Gardens, pop in and have a look at the outdoor display or visit our website, rte.ie/Mooney. Now, while we were at the gardens the other day, this lady called Margaret came up to myself and Niall and Matthew Jebb and said, would we talk about mandarin duck on the programme sometime? And I said, we'll do it next Monday. And then shortly after she left, another lady came along. This is true. Pure coincidence. Her name was Grania. And she mentioned that her son, Liam, took a photograph of a mandarin duck and entered it into the Eye on Nature competition. So I said, give me your email. Let's talk to him today on the programme. And that's what we're going to do in just a moment. But I just want to say a quick hello to Niall Hatches in Greystones in County Wicklow at his home, and Richard, who's in Malahide in North County Dublin, at his home. They're going to be joining in this conversation. Now, Liam, tell me all about your photograph, please.
So, yeah, I went to Botanic Gardens one day for the Eye on Nature competition. And I happened to come across these two mandarin ducks in the pond. And they're very strange in nature. They have very, very weird colours on their body. So I approached it, and it happened to be cleaning itself. So I went up, and while it was cleaning itself, it was shaking its head. I snapped this picture, and you can see all the colours of the bird. It's a very fascinating bird.
Looking at your photograph now, Liam, can you please describe exactly what the bird looks like?
So yeah, looking at the photo here, it's sitting on a bit of foliage. It's got, you know, orange legs. It's got like a white body, like below the body, and then has all sorts of colours. Has orange feathers, has like a white face, has maybe blue velvety colours, has a lot of very different colours you can see. Very interesting bird. It's very, very hard to describe without the actual picture.
It is a beautiful bird, I have to say. Did you know what it was when you encountered it first?
No, I had no idea. I've been up to Botanic Gardens a lot. I go up there a lot for walks. But yeah, I've never seen a bird like this in Botanic Gardens or anywhere else, to be honest.
So whereabouts in the gardens was it?
It was in the main pond where you normally see all the ducks. So there was a large amount of ducks and there was a few people feeding the ducks. And then there was these two mandarin ducks over to the corner, not getting as much attention. But I'd never seen them before, so I went straight over.
Niall, what do you think about this?
They are beautiful birds, and it is hard to describe them. I always think that mandarin ducks look like a child's drawing, like they went to town with the crayons and let their imagination run wild. But that's really what the bird looks like. It's mainly orange and white, I suppose, but with these amazing sail feathers up on the back and this wonderful sort of swept back, almost like a hairdo that they have. The Latin name for the bird, actually, it's Aix galericulata. Aix is a water bird, and the second part there is the Latin for a wig. So it looks like it's wearing sort of a very swept back wig. Of course, when I'm describing that, I'm describing the male, because as is the case with most ducks, the female is much drabber and more camouflaged in her plumage. You'd never think that the two of them were the same species. She's sort of a dullish grey, dark grey overall, with a pale stripe sweeping back from her eye. Relatively small duck, a good bit smaller than the mallard that many people will be familiar with, roughly the size of a tufted duck, a little bigger. In Dublin, which is where they occur at the moment, they tend to be quite confiding. And the reason for that is that it's not a native species. All of the mandarin ducks that we have in Ireland are descended from birds that escaped from captivity or that were deliberately released. We know that a few years ago in Blessington Street Basin, which is a place we often speak about on this programme.
Indeed.
Somebody seems to have released a whole load of exotic wildfowl in there, which actually was illegal, but they've seemed to have taken hold. There are several different species. There's a bird called a hooded merganser, which occurs there. It's often reported now from the basin. There is a bird called a smew, which is a European duck. Bahama pintails, which come from the West Indies and from Central and South America. A wood duck, which is the North American counterpart of the mandarin duck. And several mandarin ducks, which hail from Eastern Asia. So it's a bird that I've been fortunate enough to see in the wild in the Russian Far East near to Vladivostok and also in Japan. And I had the very unusual experience of actually seeing a whole group of mandarins in the town of Satsuma. So it was a very citrus fruit related day when I saw those. But interestingly, there is quite a large feral population of them now in Britain, particularly in southern England. And that's actually become of conservation significance, because normally when you have an introduced species like this, a non-native species, it causes problems. But the fact is, in its native range in East Asia, the mandarin duck is now a very rare bird. There's probably only about 7,000 or so of them left in the wild. So the population in Britain, the non-native population, is actually probably larger than the one in its native range. So it's of conservation significance. There's also populations now in places like the Netherlands, and it's a bird that's widely kept in captivity because it is such a beautiful looking bird. And it's revered in a lot of East Asian folklore and culture and mythology because it's such a beautiful bird. It's also seen as a symbol of faithfulness because it's very, the pair seem very devoted to each other. So it's long been associated with love, kind of the way that the turtle dove is in Europe.
Richard.
Liam, do you watch Yes Minister?
No.
Well, Yes Minister is about what are called mandarins. The word mandarin is very widely used in all kinds of countries. Mandarin oranges, for instance. And in Yes Minister, you have Sir Humphrey, who is the archetypal mandarin. Now, the mandarins were Chinese intellectual civil servants that worked for the emperor. So it's a rather funny term. But they weren't a bit glamorous. But the duck is totally glamorous. Now, one of the interesting things about these ducks is that they nest in holes in trees quite high up, which is quite extraordinary. The wood duck from America that Niall mentioned does the same thing, and so does the golden eye and various others. But it is unusual for a duck to go way up a tree and into a hole and nest there. Now, there was a very interesting experiment done in Slimbridge in the 1950s, I think it was way back, anyway, a good bit back, because back then there was some research on human babies. human babies to see if they have an innate fear of heights. The baby was put on this device which had a glass structure, and there was what looked like a sheer fall. Human babies avoided going over to that side. There was no sheer fall. There was glass there. He was protected. But they always turn back. Now, the interesting thing about mandarin ducks is they're going to come out of a nest, out of the dark, in a hole. And they're going to be confronted with perhaps a 10-metre drop, 30 feet. Now, the interesting thing then was to see what was the duck's attitude to height. So this experiment constructs the thing like the thing the human babies are tested on. But they put several species of duck down in this systematically to see would they go towards the steep end or would they go towards the shallow end of this thing, escape from the edge where they might fall, or think they might fall. Now, the mandarins headed off in both directions, couldn't care less about the drop, whereas birds that nested on the ground, the chicks from them, they did not go towards the far end. They knew that this was dangerous, whereas the mandarin ducks knew that they had to jump. And in fact, to prove the theory, the mandarin ducks used to crouch when they got to the end and prepare themselves to actually leap, even though there was no need to do that. But it's a very interesting experiment about them.
Richard, I might just point out that I think Liam is only 22, and Yes Minister, followed by Yes Prime Minister, was a British political satirical sitcom which was on BBC television in the 1980s. I don't even think you were around then, Liam, were you?
No, I'm sure I can find it on Netflix, though.
Well, actually, they're repeating it on BBC Two at the moment, so you can see it there. It's very entertaining. Niall?
Yeah, I'd highly recommend it. Derek, you loaned me the DVDs of it several years ago and I thoroughly enjoyed it. So Liam, yeah, you should definitely check that out. You won't learn much about ducks from it, though, but it's certainly a fascinating bird. Tell me, was it hard to take the photograph of it, or was the duck tame or approachable? Did you notice anything about that?
So the duck was actually in its own world, to be honest. It was just swimming all by itself. Well, but the other duck, I had a long lens, so I was about 4 or 5 metres away from it. So the picture looks like it's up close, but I was actually a good bit away from it to not disturb it. But it was fairly tame, it was fairly calm. It felt like just one of the other ducks, like, you know, wasn't behaving any differently.
Who knows, you might be able to enter the Eye on Nature competition next year with a shot of that bird. It certainly would be a very eye-catching entry, I would say. It's interesting that, the differences between the birds in the native range in East Asia and the ones that are here in Europe, it's really down to their tameness, because I tried to photograph them when I came across them in a forest in Russia, and they're so scared of people there. They're really very shy bird. They live in the dense forest. They live in pools in the woodlands. And they've one of the reasons why they're so rare is they've been hunted for a long time, both for food and for their plumage. Because it's so beautiful. Maybe that's why they've evolved a fear of humans there. The introduced populations in Europe, including the ones that we have now in Dublin in small numbers, they, as I said, are descended from captive birds that have long been associating with humans. They link us with food, so they're much more tame. And in fact, it seems that mandarin ducks are really unable to survive far away from people. We haven't seen them expanding out of urban areas in Ireland. They're staying in the areas where people give them easy handouts, where they get bread and other food thrown to them. So they do seem to be expanding in the city. It'd be interesting now, Liam, to see if you see any more of them in other parts of the city. I expect they may well be here to stay, but probably won't be able to survive much without human assistance, I would think.
Yeah, no, I have been down to Botanic Gardens since, and I haven't seen them again. So I'm not sure where they are now, but I'll keep an eye out for them.
One of the reasons why they do better in Britain and on the continent is because, as Richard said, they need to nest in trees. They nest inside holes, and they don't make those themselves. They usually use old woodpecker holes. And up until recently, of course, we didn't have any woodpeckers in Ireland. The great spotted woodpecker has colonised. It's been in the country for about 15 years or so now, colonised Wicklow and also in County Down. They're slowly spreading. So as they increase and they're producing more holes in trees for their own nests, maybe the mandarin duck will also increase, because all of a sudden it'll have more nesting opportunities. It's certainly interesting to see what happens.
I wouldn't emphasize the foreignness of this thing too much. There is a group of mandarins breeding in Northern Ireland. Back, I don't know how long, 20 years ago or thereabouts, in Tullymore Forest Park, a pinioned pair bred there, and they let the youngsters go, and two pairs, I think, and they let the youngsters run wild, and they have formed a breeding colony in Northern Ireland. So the mandarin is part of our fauna now. Well, one of the curious things about it, in Buddhist tradition, It was the symbol of marital fidelity. It was thought that, the Chinese thought that if a mandarin, one of a pair died, the partner would pine away and die too. This is a kind of myth you get. That's said of swans here in Ireland. It isn't true, but they thought it might be. And when a Buddhist couple married, they were presented with a pair of mandarin ducks as a kind of symbol of their expected fidelity. But the irony is that the more brightly coloured a duck tends to be, the less faithful it tends. But bright colours tend to be a sign of promiscuity and loose morals generally. Well, now the mandarin duck is the most glamorous.
What do you mean bright colours are a sign of loose morals? Says who?
In nature, there are these rules of thumb. And if you dress up like a peacock, for instance, or pheasants, things like that, you are securing a multitude of females, usually. So you want to dress up and make yourself extremely attractive so that you can seduce as many as possible. Well, now, in the case of mandarin ducks, they are with their wings, they have these little sails sticking up, and they have kind of wings sticking out around the throat. And these are extraordinary ornaments, and they are about, but it isn't actually a very promiscuous duck. It is monogamous, plus the odd flirtation, plus occasionally bigamy, but it is by no means a very good symbol of marital fidelity, despite what the Buddhist thought.
Certainly when it comes to that fancy plumage that the male has, it's a perfect example of what's called sexual selection, whereby female preference has governed the bizarre shape and plumage colours of the males. Because there has to be a downside to this. The male is very conspicuous and visible, where the female is very camouflaged and much harder to spot. I imagine that this must shorten the lifespans of those males. The sails on their wings must make them flying quite awkward as well, and they're very visible to predators. So it's all about trying to attract the females and mate with them and pass on their genes. And if that leads to a shortened lifespan, well, so be it. It's the female's choice over millions of years that has led to this. But it's not just the female mandarin ducks who find this very attractive. There was a case just a couple of years ago in Central Park in New York where a very famous mandarin duck suddenly turned up on the main duck lake there in Central Park in New York City. And it became a big celebrity, really, and it became known as the hot duck, or also Mandarin Patinkin, after Mandy Patinkin, the actor, you know, who was in the Princess Bride and Homeland and various other things. And there was t-shirts made of this. There was all sorts of pictures of this duck circulating on social media. And when it disappeared, people were mourning about it. It became sort of this urban legend around New York City, to the extent that I saw that even Bette Midler, of all people, has just published a children's book all about this hot duck. So that's where mandarins have been making the media or making the news in recent years.
Actually, Liam, I think you're going to have to make a t-shirt out of it now, out of your photograph.
Yeah, I'm going to make a business out of this. It sounds very, very positive. Liam Corcoran on LinkedIn, you'll find me.
Okay, Liam, thank you very much indeed. Much appreciated. By the way, it's not really fair to ask you this because you were one of the 7,000 plus people who entered our Eye on Nature competition this year. But did you see the winner, and what did you think of the winning photograph?
Yeah, I saw the winner. Yeah, no, it was very good. I was up there in Botanic Gardens the other day, and all of the finalists are extremely good. There's some crazy pictures there, but I loved the winning one. The macro lens was fantastic on it, so fair play to him.
Liam, thanks very much indeed, and we'll talk to you again.
Take it easy. Thank you.
And if you want to have a look at Liam's photograph, just visit our website, rte.ie/Mooney. And I can assure you, if you see it once, you'll never forget what a mandarin duck looks like. So if you ever happen upon one, you'll know what it is and you'll remember where you saw it first. I want to move on now to a piece of music we played a couple of weeks ago during our Mooney Goes Wildlife quiz. It formed part of one of Richard's questions, and it's by the English composer Ralph Vaughan Williams. It's called The Lark Ascending. Only when I mixed it into Richard's question, I added a skylark singing alongside it. Have a listen, and then I'll come back to the panel. We've had a lot of people inquiring about this piece of music because they're saying that in its original form, there is no skylark.
Well, of course there isn't. It's actually, you put the skylark in to show.
I did.
Very cleverly, and that's the whole point of this thing. The Lark Ascending is actually the title of a poem that inspired Vaughan Williams by George Meredith. And the poem, in a funny way, mimics the skylark. The skylark rises, and he sings constantly. He doesn't, almost all songbirds sing a little burst, and then they pause to hear, is there anybody answering? Is there any rival out there? And then they sing again. But the skylark doesn't. He keeps on going, going. Enormous energy, flying up higher and higher and higher into the sky. And Meredith's poem mimics that. And of course, then our friend, I forget how it goes, he rises and begins to round, he drops the silver chain of sound, of many links without a break, in chirrup, whistle, slur and shake. Now, what Meredith has done in words, the continuous stream of short phrases, Vaughan Williams, you know, was a great grand nephew of Charles Darwin, believe it or not. He was related to Darwin, also to Josiah Wedgwood, who was his great great grandfather, I think. And he was a left wing kind of person, a committed socialist and agnostic.
And what's wrong with that?
Well, it's just to give a picture of the man, you see. And he thought, well, the socialist element I want to bring in, because he thought that music, the kind of music he was writing, should not be for the elite. It should be for everybody. He didn't like the idea of patronising the rich and famous in big concert halls where people couldn't get in because they couldn't afford the tickets if they hadn't a lot of money. But in this particular piece, one critic said of it, it is not music of the concert hall. It is music of the countryside. And you know, that's very true. Now, if you listen to it, you hear the cadence going, little phrases worked in, an extraordinary piece of music and extraordinarily popular. It was 50 years old. Well, when just after the First World War, it was composed before it for piano and violin. And then it was actually rewritten for piano and orchestra by him after the First World War. And of course, he himself played the violin. He didn't like the piano. He liked the violin. That is a kind of background to it. But I think it's a wonderful piece, virtuoso piece, rather like the lark's virtuoso. The lark keeps going. He never stops. How does he get the energy? He drops like a stone at the end. He pulls the wings in and falls, or at least some of them do. There's some five pairs up where near where I am, and one of them constantly, when he rises up 50 metres or so, he gets exhausted and he pulls the wings in and he falls like a skydiver all the way down, and just before he hits the ground he opens the wings again. But the other four don't do that. They drop off on the way down and take a little break and then fall another bit. Falling the whole way, it seems to me a little dangerous because there might be a predator down there. Going down in little bursts and opening the wings and watching out for what's there seems to me wiser, because if there is a threat there, you will spot it earlier. But anyway, you've triggered me to wander off in the fantasy about this piece of music. I'm sorry about
the Collins Ascending, I think.
Yes, you see, I'm mimicking, let on it's conscious, that I'm mimicking the skylark in my reply, Derek. How about that?
You did a very good impression there, Richard. I was listening to my first skylark singing of the season on St. Patrick's Day. I took a walk along Kilcool Beach, which is within 5 kilometres of my house here in Greystones, and was thrilled to see a lark rising up into the air and singing. And Vaughan Williams really did a remarkable job of capturing in music that flow of that melody, this jumble of notes. It's very, very pretty, but what really is impresses me about it is the stamina of it. This bird is going higher and higher, singing all the time. And of course, it kind of relates back to what I said about the mandarin ducks, about the sexual selection and how female choice has led the males to take on this risky behaviour. So in the mandarins, it's the flashy plumage. In the skylark, it's this conspicuous song flight that they do, because the females are impressed by the bravest males, the ones who will go higher and sing loudest. And when they're doing that, of course, they are giving their position away to every predator in the neighbourhood. So any kind of hawk or falcon will see them and hear them very easily and will come in to try and get them. So it's kind of showing off a bit of bravado. And it shows that if he's able to survive that and he's confident in his own abilities to avoid a predator, he'll be a very good father for any chicks that they would have, because he'll pass on very good genes to any offspring they'll have together. So that's what's happening there. So the male is taking this risk. So you know, he must be sweating it. It must be, you know, very tense behavior for him. We humans can just enjoy it for what it is. And one of the things that always I find amazing is just how they can keep this constant stream of notes, sometimes for minutes on end without taking a break. And people often ask me, know, how is that bird breathing? You know, it's not pausing for breath at all. The thing is, though, that birds can sing when they're both when they're breathing in and when they're breathing out. So we humans, like most mammals, when we want to make a sound, so when I'm speaking right now, I'm breathing air out. If I want to continue speaking, every so often I'll have to stop. I'll have to take a big breath in and then I'll have to continue breathing out. I can't speak when I'm breathing in. Birds aren't constrained in the same way. Whether the air is coming in or going out, they can keep singing this constant flow of notes. So that's one of the reasons why the skylark sounds so impressive to us. It's something that we could never do.
There's an interesting contrast there, and Vaughan Williams makes the violin the bird, but he has the orchestra, in a sense, as one critic said, the Times critic, I think it was, evokes the ground. It's the ground perspective between the bird away up there and this thing low down. So it's a very interesting thing. And we're talking about the risks and dangers. Skylarks live a rather precarious life. They have to have three broods, usually, and sometimes four indeed, in order to get enough chicks fledged to keep themselves going. You have to leave behind enough offspring to replace you and your partner, after all, at the end of it. And they have to do rather well because they're very vulnerable. They're vulnerable to rats and rodents and dogs and people walking, and in some places there might be cattle. It is a precarious existence, but that in a sense is triumphant in a way, that he can brave it out and succeed. And it's a wonderful bird, the skylark.
It is. And that's one of the problems that a lot of these ground nesting birds have. So birds like skylarks that build their nests on the ground, they are very prone to disturbance. And that's one of the reasons why the skylark is now a much rarer bird than it would have been when Vaughan Williams first composed this piece of music. Back then, everybody or almost everybody would have been very familiar with the sound of the skylark. So they would hear that piece of music and would immediately think, oh, that reminds me of a skylark. That's exactly what they sound like, or the way that they behave. Nowadays, a lot of people have never heard one. We've become kind of divorced from that kind of natural world, and skylarks really are declining. So it is always a treat for me when I do hear one. I hope it's a species that more people will get a chance to hear in the future, but it doesn't look too good for that bird, unfortunately.
Well, can I ask you both now, you've all been to the optician and you know the way they try you with different lenses, and they say, with or without, the first one or the second one? Are you ready, Richard and Niall? This is Vaughan Williams minus the skylark. So have a listen now, tell me if you like it. Like this, Richard? You like this now?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. Niall?
That's what I'm used to.
Yes, it's a very pleasant piece of music. Very pretty.
Now, here it is with the skylark. What do you think of it with the skylark?
Admit I prefer it that way, just because I love skylarks so much. So anytime I get to hear a real skylark, I'll take that over the artificial variety anytime.
Richard?
Yes, I rather like that. After all, it is about the skylark, and why shouldn't he be a soloist? You know, apparently there are modes in music, different scales and things, and Vaughan Williams flitted from one mode to another. Now, and remember, Vaughan Williams was a great collector of folk melodies and things, and they influenced him greatly, and some of these folk melodies were in various modes. Anyway, I'm getting carried away again. I must call a halt. But it's the most beautiful piece, really.
Getting carried away because nature is beautiful. That is indeed the beauty of nature, to get us carried away. Anyway, Niall, thank you very much indeed. We'll talk to you a little bit later on. We're going to move on now because we've got to talk about elephants. Now, believe it or not, for 95% of our time on Earth, we humans sustained ourselves by foraging. Can you believe it? That is hunting and gathering food from our natural surroundings. Today, only a few contemporary societies are classified as hunter-gatherers, but for animals, this is key to their ability to survive and reproduce. And they must adapt to their changing environments. For example, the desert elephant populations of southern Africa move according to rainfall and vegetation. And Sri Lankan elephants regularly swarm landfill sites and rubbish dumps looking for food scraps. Now, you might remember earlier this year, we spoke with Kerry McRae, who is originally from County Tyrone, but moved to Thailand, where she set up the Kindred Spirit Elephant Sanctuary. Kerry's been looking at how elephants forage mixed deciduous woodlands in North Thailand, from where she joined us earlier to tell us about her research.
Hello, Kerry. It's great to talk to you, particularly on tourist industries. And I expect the tourist industry in Thailand has suffered also. Now, that should affect elephants, because elephants carry tourists around and they're employed by these institutions which cater for tourists. But now suddenly all those elephants are unemployed, are they?
Yes, that is correct. So right now, because of the COVID-19 pandemic, all of the elephant tourist camps have basically closed down. The ones that are still opening are struggling to keep their elephants fed, especially right now because it is the dry season and everything is basically on fire in northern Thailand. So what little food is left for the elephants is diminishing very, very quickly. It's a very worrying situation. And actually right now, over the last year, over 60 elephants have returned to our area because they have no longer a place to stay because of the lack of tourists that are before were providing them with food and with an income. So right now everyone is struggling a lot, and we are helping to support the 60 plus elephants as best as we can to make sure that they are getting enough food over this crisis period.
Now, the food requirements for an elephant are very large. How many kilos of vegetation is needed for an elephant every day, and how much water? And is this a real problem?
So the amount of food that an elephant eats per day is about 200 kilograms, which when you have 60 plus elephants, maybe even 70 plus elephants in the area, that is a huge amount of food that they will go through in one day. And the same with water. Like right now, it is the dry season. There is not a lot of water that is also left in the area too because of the dry season. Elephants can drink over 100 liters of water per day. So it's a very dire situation. Like I said, we're all working very hard to do lots of fundraising to help keep these elephants fed and help keep these elephants watered so that they can continue to thrive and survive and live in their natural habitat as much as possible.
Now, you've been conducting research on foraging among your elephants, and I think it's true to say that you have discovered that elephants have huge diversity in their food. They feed on all kinds of plants, a great variety of plants.
Yes, so from our research, we've actually discovered that our five elephants that we've been watching over the last 5 years have eaten 165 different species of plants, which is an incredible amount and is more than has ever been recorded before. So for the younger elephants who have been growing up in tourism and haven't been home to the forest before, like I said before, they will just watch what their other elephants will be eating, what the older elephants will be eating, and they will follow what they eat. So they will be getting all of these new different tastes and new textures. Because quite often, unfortunately, in tourism, elephants are usually only fed one or two different types of plants because that's what the people can source in that area. Whereas in our area, the elephants are able to roam naturally and forage naturally. So they have eaten over 165 different species of plants, which of course improves their health and improves their nutrition and improves their welfare in the process.
So life has never been as good, has it?
Well, that's definitely one way to look at it. The elephants are, you know, they're continuing to be taken care of by their owners and by the mahouts. But the owners and the mahouts themselves are the ones who are really struggling. Like I said, they all come from a very low income background. And now their main source of income, which is the tourism industry, has been taken away from them. And now they're struggling to feed their elephants because right now it is the dry season, like I said, and also the burning season. Everyone is having to make at least a 3-hour journey to find enough food for the elephants to bring back to the village and then take it into the forest so they can then feed the elephants with this food. And right now there's just not enough food left in the forest for all of the elephants that are in our area. So although the elephants are living out their days as best as they can, the struggle is very real for the people that are taking care of them.
Elephants in zoos, Indian elephants in zoos, live only half as long as wild elephants do, or even half as long as those that work in the logging industry live. Is this down to inadequate diet, or is it a more complex phenomenon?
It could be down to, or is most likely down to, a number of different factors, including the diet. Like I said, our elephants are able to eat a great amount of variety of different types of plants. And even the elephants in the tourism industry, as I mentioned, will come home and stay in the forest for a couple of months every couple of years. So they all have this variety that they have access to from time to time. But also in zoos, the enclosures that the elephants live in, although even some of them might be quite big, they're never really big enough. For example, with our elephants, they can sometimes walk up to 5 kilometers per day, and they've got the space to be able to do that. But the enclosures that are in the zoos will never be able to meet that need. So quite often the elephants will show stereotypical behaviors because of this. They will kind of bounce from one leg to the next, or they'll do head bopping stereotype. And that can often lead to arthritis, which in the end is quite detrimental to the health of the elephant. And sometimes elephants have to be put down because of that in the zoo industry. So there's a number of different factors that include welfare and diet that contribute to the very low lifespan of elephants in zoos.
Do you think that Indian elephants should not be kept in zoos? Do you think they should be used in the tourist industry in Thailand? And do you think they should be used in the logging industry at all?
So it is a very complicated situation. I mean, in a perfect world, the elephants wouldn't have to be in captivity. They would all be in the wild. But even in the wild, you know, there is many factors that contribute to their lifespan there as well. Like, the wild can be a very stressful environment for an elephant to live into, especially if there's predators or poachers that are a constant threat to their existence. So in a way, elephants in captivity are needed to keep the Asian elephant alive, because otherwise they are going very quickly extinct in the wild, unfortunately. So sometimes, you know, captivity is needed, but the extent that elephants are kept in captivity, in my opinion, it is a little bit too much, and it should be controlled more, and there should be a lot more emphasis on the elephant welfare and regulations for the elephant welfare.
Now, there are figures from India which say that 400 people are killed by Asian elephants every year. Now, in Thailand, the elephants that work for people, familiarity breeds contempt in a sense, and they get too familiar with people. Are they more dangerous in the wild than a truly wild one would be? That's certainly true of other creatures. Once they get used to people, they don't fear people. And so if they get angry, and they're a bit unpredictable like other elephants, they're likely to turn on people spontaneously and surprisingly.
Yes, that definitely happens, especially with male elephants. Male elephants in captivity are very difficult to manage, and quite often there are instances where these male elephants will act out and they will kill their mahout, or they could even kill a tourist if the tourist gets too close to them on the wrong day. So it's a very real fear, and something that definitely needs to be looked into further about how this can be managed more with elephants in captivity. Because in the wild, when you see an elephant, you know not to get close to it. But as you said, in captivity, they are unpredictable, but still people feel like they are able to get close to them. So that's why a more hands-off approach is probably the best way to go, even with elephants in captivity, because they can be unpredictable and it's definitely not always safe to be close to them.
Now, presumably, you are very close to your 5 elephants, and they have a very curious... They're all related to each other. When an elephant, a young elephant, is brought in after some years away, does its mother recognise it? Does it take up where they left off some years previously? Or is it a total stranger as far as the existing elephants are concerned?
So elephants are very intelligent animals and they can always recognize each other. So for example, when we brought our elephants back together for the first time, we had a young female, Meidum, who was in her early 20s, and she hadn't seen her mother or her nephews for many years. But as soon as we brought them back together, they recognized each other straight away. You know, they were touching, they were socializing, and they were rumbling, they were trumpeting, and they were very excited to see each other and very happy to be back together with each other. And since that moment, Meidum and her mother Tume have not left each other's sides. They are quite literally joined at the hip. So when you see one, you always see the other close by. They're never more than a few meters away. So it's quite incredible that the fact that these two elephants were essentially separated for about 15 years, but when they're brought back together, they know each other and they have that bond still.
One of your elephants, I gather, is an orphan because its mother was chained to a tree. And there was a wasp's nest up the tree, and this detached and fell down and stung the poor mother, and she died as a result. But the calf ran away and became an orphan and is now one of your five elephants. Now, does a trauma like that permanently alter the behaviour of an elephant, as it would in us? If something traumatic happened in childhood, we'd be affected by it for life. Is that the case in elephants?
It's definitely very difficult to say for sure. I really wish we could talk to our elephants and have them communicate back to us so that we would be able to have a conversation and talk about what they went through and how that affected them. But unfortunately, we can't. So all we have to work with is following their behavior. And the elephant that you're speaking of, Gentong, he was orphaned at 2 years old. So he lost his mother at a very young age. And since then, he has become a very unpredictable elephant. So he has many behavioral problems. He quite often doesn't want to listen to his mahout. He will often play up, often play fight together with the other elephants, or often will charge off on his own. And it's difficult to say if that's just the way that he is because of his personality. Elephants all have very different personalities from each other. Or it could perhaps be the reaction to the traumatic event that happened when he was younger. It's difficult to say, but that would be my guess.
Well, I must say, Kerry, you are doing marvellous work and you are to be congratulated indeed for the great work that you are doing. Where do you go from here?
So from here, we're basically playing a waiting game with the pandemic and waiting for tourism to open up again so that we can accept guests and interns again and continue our research and continue to educate people on the Asian elephant in Thailand and on how they can help them and how they can help us help them. So right now, all we're doing is fundraising and providing for elephants and also providing food and providing donations to the 60 plus elephants that are in our area to make sure that no elephant goes without food and no elephant dies from starvation, and that we are, yeah, just contributing and providing for everyone as much as possible.
Well done, and thank you very much. And I hope we'll have a chat again in a few months' time. Goodbye for now.
Goodbye. Thanks for having me.
I have to say, I really do admire the work that Kerry McRae is doing there. More details on our website, rte.ie/Mooney. Also, while you're there, have a look at the winning photograph from the inaugural RTE Eye on Nature Wildlife Photography Competition. You heard the voice of the winner earlier on, Larry Doherty. His picture is of an orange ladybird. But what is an orange ladybird? Here's Terry Flanagan.
Well, Derek, an orange ladybird is just that. It's an orange ladybird. And it's one of the 19 species of ladybirds found in Ireland. It's bright orange, has 16 cream-coloured spots, and it's found mostly in trees. And the one that Larry photographed was found in a beech tree. Ladybirds have a worldwide distribution. Mostly they're predators of other insects. They're often named after the number of spots they possess. So we have the 2-spot, the 7-spot, the 11-spot, and so on. We tend to think of ladybirds as red beetles with black spots, although they don't have to be red. The lady in ladybird refers to the Virgin Mary. Legend has it that crops in Europe during the Middle Ages were plagued by pests. So the farmers began praying to the Blessed Lady, the Virgin Mary. Soon, the farmers started seeing ladybirds in the fields. and the crops were miraculously saved from these pests. They associated their good fortune with these black and red beetles, and so began calling them lady beetles or ladybirds. In Germany, these insects go by the name Marienkäfer, which means Mary beetles. The red colour represents her cloak, and the black spots represent her sorrows. But in the States, they're known as ladybugs. And in Irish, we know them as the Boeing Day, or the little cow of God. Names in Irish that end in een, like Pinkeen, little pink fish, or Noreen, little Nora, Maureen, Shawneen, Micheline. The een means little, so Boeing Day is the little cow of God. And the collective name for ladybirds is a loveliness of ladybirds. Now, they are insects, and one of the characteristics of insects is that they possess two pairs of wings. Think of dragonflies flying along on a summer's evening, and you can see the two pairs of wings beating. Well, in the case of the ladybird, it has evolved somewhat, and the first pair is not used for flight. These tough forewings cover the delicate hind wings, which are used for flight. So they act as a protective case. And it's on this protective case where you find the spots. Now, you can't tell the age by the spots, because the spots fade. The most common ladybird found in Ireland is the seven spot. This one has three spots on each wing case and one across both wing cases. And it has an incredible appetite for aphids. In fact, it's known as the gardener's friend, and it's a great example of biological control. So, if you're growing tomatoes in your greenhouse and they become infected with greenfly, why spray chemicals on them? Let the ladybirds do the job. In very good summers, we come across swarms of ladybirds. In fact, we did a report from County Wexford in 2013 on a swarm of millions of them. And in 1976, there was a massive swarm on the south coast of England. Conditions were very favourable, hot weather and an abundance of aphids. And it was estimated that on any one day during that summer, there were over 23 billion, yes, billion, ladybirds on the south and east coast of England. And to put that in perspective, Derek, that's more than all the humans that have ever existed on Earth. But if you want to see them flying, the temperature has to be above 13 degrees centigrade. Although they take a little time to become airborne, once in the air, they beat their wings about 85 times a second. According to legend, they can be used to predict the weather. If one falls off your hand, it will rain. If it flies away, it'll be fine. You may find ladybirds in the house. They sometimes overwinter there, but there's no need to worry. They don't eat fabric or furniture. Although ladybirds are thought to be quiet insects, recent research has provided recordings from the inside of the insect. Using atomic force microscopy, scientists from Clarkson University in New York have managed to listen in to see what's going on inside their bodies. It is hoped that the study of these sounds may allow the researchers to understand unknown features of these insects. So, Derek, I'm going to leave you with the internal sounds of a ladybird.
That is an extraordinary sound, I have to say. It sounds like something you might hear on a spaceship. Could be directly from Star Trek. Anyway, thank you very much indeed, Terry. That was fascinating. Now, Annie Nilana joins us. She is wearing her President of the Tree Council of Ireland hat at the moment, and she wants to talk about National Tree Week. Do you not, Aina?
Yes, indeed I do, Derek. I want to talk about National Tree Week, which is this week, started on Monday, and it goes right through until next Saturday. So the last week in March. Of course, the problem is that we have COVID, nobody can go anywhere. So we're having a virtual week. Now, the theme, of course, is healthy trees mean a healthy planet. So this encourages people to consider trees as a means of improving their own mental health, as well as healthy trees helping the planet, of course, by taking carbon out of the atmosphere and being a home for biodiversity. So during National Tree Week, Quilcha, who are our sponsors, have given 100,000 trees for the whole year, and 15,000 of those are being planted by local authorities during this week on with their own people. So there's no public events as such that we would have had other years. So we're going virtual on our website, treecouncil.ie. There's free webinars all week. Different members, different directors are given a webinar each day. I'm doing one on spring trees. Cormac Downey is doing one on heritage trees. Orla Farrell is doing one on planting trees. There's a whole list of them. You can see them there. And we, of course, have a competition, a photographic competition, because you're nobody if you haven't got a photographic competition these days. Take a picture of a tree that you've taken over the last 12 months in Ireland. It doesn't have to be a native tree. And send it in to us along with an account of why this tree is important to you. And there's actually cash prizes for this, so you get the details of all that on the website. But the message really for National Tree Week from me, the President of the Tree Council of Ireland, is go out and enjoy your trees this week. And if you can, plant one, because planting a tree is one of the most important things that you can do. So,
how many of the trees that are planted actually survive, Aina?
Well, a lot of them do, Derek, like everything else. You know, if they're planted too near or they're not watered or they're weeded, not weeded properly, they will have trouble. But I go back to schools year after year and they've been planting trees each year and I see the thickets growing up. So I know that the trees actually do survive. Local authorities have their professional planters, so they survive well enough. So we've planted, since the National Tree Week began over 30 years ago, we've planted something like 250,000 trees for Ireland. The Tree Council has during National Tree Week. So it does make a significant difference. And they do survive, the most of them do, Derek, they do, really.
Well, they have a better chance of surviving now. There's less people out to trample on them. But you said you're giving a webinar on spring trees. Cottis Brila Shin.
Well, you see, the thing is that it's very easy to identify a tree when you have the leaves. It's like looking at somebody and you see their face and you know what they look like. But in spring, in the deciduous trees, the leaves haven't come yet. So you have to look for the clues. So I'll be talking about catkins, because some of our trees have catkins before the leaves. Things like hazel, things like poplar, things like pussy willow. I'll be talking about the flowers that come before the leaves, like you get on the blackthorn. I'll be looking at very distinctive buds that you might have on the horse chestnut or you might have on the ash tree. The oak tree is the only one with multiple buds on it, and I'll show slides of that and how we would identify those. And indeed, things like the beech have very pointy buds and a lovely grey bark. So you don't have to wait till the leaves come in order to be able to identify your trees, because people like to know the name of something that they're looking at while they're out walking. It adds to their enjoyment. So you can do it in springtime too. It's not quite as easy, but this is the honours lesson. This is the honours class. This is the one I'm doing, Derek. Flowers and trees in the springtime.
I assume, given you're encouraging people to plant trees now, that it is a good time of year to do it.
Yes, you have to. These are bare-rooted trees, which means that you have to plant them before they really begin to grow, before the leaves start to come. So the end of March, this is really the very last of it in a sense. We've been planting them since last November for the whole of the winter period. But if you have a tree in a flower pot, you buy a tree in a pot in a garden centre, well, then you can transplant it from the pot to the garden or to the place you're planting it all the year round. It doesn't matter. It's only the bare-rooted trees that you're stuck with having to get planted and into the ground before the leaves start coming on them.
More details on our website, rte.ie/Mooney. That's all we have time for today. My thanks to Aina Nilauna, you just heard her there, to Dr. Richard Collins, to Niall Hatch, to all of our contributors, our broadcast coordinator, Jarlath Holland, and researcher, John Bella Riley. Until next week, goodbye.
Mooney Goes Wild is presented and produced by Derek Mooney.